Hello everybody, James here, and it's Ask Dutch Anything. We're going to do a very, 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 very quick version of the plug. So, very quickly, Dutch has got two books and I've got two books. If you want either of our books that either of us have done, you can go to Amazon. We've got links in the description of this video and every other video and podcast, etc. If you want Dutch's books signed by Dutch, not me, you go to dirtydutchmantel@gmail.com. He also has diplomas for sale that are going like hotcakes, as we always say. Also, potentially cards, what are they called? The collector's cards from WCW. He's got about 4 million of them. Jimmy D. Hopper. There is University of Dutch, an example of the diploma that you can get as well.
We're it's also, just not signed yet.
Not signed yet, but it will be when you order it from Dirty Dutch Mantel with two.
Yeah, you got to you got to graduate first.
The check's got to clear for you to graduate this.
It's what you mail.
What else? Pro wrestling tees, of course. Dutch Mantel official T-shirt wear of the podcast and Dutch Mantel in general. And there is the prototype for the video viewers. The prototype Dirty Dutch Mantel figure that is not for sale. He just likes showing it. Now, we are going to be doing an hour, or maybe a tiny bit less than an hour, actually, because we overran on the other podcast somewhat. So about 50 minutes or so of questions that you have submitted via questionsfordutch@gmail.com. And that is just what this guy has done. And for whatever reason, I've picked the most complicated name to begin with. So, Quezzy Guaza. There you go.
Always watch questions from a guy called Quezzy Guaza.
Yes, says, hey, Dutch and James, I'm sure that you must have seen that some of the old-timers that have been in the wrestling business tend to have surgeries and feel the pain and the body aches after retiring from the ring. I would like to know if that thing has got to do with the type of rings back in the day in terms of not protecting the wrestlers because the work was safe, unlike today. P.S., I would also like to know, when did they start to change the rings? So, do you think the majority of injuries for older wrestlers derived from the rings themselves being harder than Chinese algebra?
I don't think so. Not back in the old days. You just didn't take bumps. That's when you actually learned to work on the mat, taking your time, because those rings, I think, were harder than concrete. The old WWF rings didn't give. It just... walking across it would be like walking across a lobby in some bank. It's hard as a rock. So you take, and it didn't take a lot of bumps to figure that out. You take a hip toss or an arm drag, and you said, "Up, I don't think anymore." And that's when you watch some old WWF matches, you see the guys walking and talking mostly. That's why they're kind of boring. And the old timers, if you were a young guy and you get in the ring with an old timer, he'd pinch you on the shoulder. Take it easy, kid. Take it easy. And you try to hip toss him, and he just locked down on it. And then sometime locking down was accompanied by a slap right across your ear. Bam. He said, "Didn't I tell you to calm down?" And you only needed one of those to say, "Well, okay, I didn't know you were adamant on it, but I'll calm it down now." Yeah, they were very, very hard. I mean, I saw them put up a ring or two like that. Oh, man, they had no give. Now, the rings now are a lot... less hard. They give more. Now, if you see some rings and the guys bounce up, I've seen rings that had so much bounce in them, you would hit and a guy laying on the mat, and when it would come back up, it would actually spring you to your feet. That's a little bit too much. So, yeah, it was one thing is to work into the ring back in those days, which said no bumps, and to work now, it's a lot more giving, and you can see a lot of bumps. What was the last question he asked?
Well, I'll ask that in a second. I just want to make mention, because you mentioned WWF. Apparently, the rings were so hard in the Northeast because they were always set up, reinforced for battle royals, regardless if they had a battle royal or not. but I think Vince's idea was, well, you never know when you're going to want to book one.
Well, from what I understand, who taught Vince about his hard range was Jerry Jarrett. And Jerry Jarrett said, hey, man, these guys can't take those bumps. And Vince, I'm sure he's heard about it, but he wasn't taking the bumps. So it didn't really bother him that much at all, really. But I guess Jerry Jarrett introduced him to just how they make a less hard ring. And it didn't take a genius to figure it out. And then all of a sudden, you think guys could take bumps like they do in WWE now?
No.
On a ring that they used to use? They wouldn't get up.
No.
Everybody would be the first guy that took the bump and couldn't get up. Guess what? All the other guys would go, they'd put the brakes on. Because, yeah, you could get hurt real bad. And the question was, have I seen them? Yes, I've seen them. I've been in them. Very hard.
The other question was, I would also like to know when they started to change the rings. Well, I can fill that one in. You can back me. We actually had Dr. Tom Pritchard on a year or so ago. And I think he may have confirmed it on that episode where I made mention, and I think he confirmed, and said that the WWF started changing the rings to be softer, more give, when Vince McMahon started wrestling and taking bumps. Because when he started taking bumps, like, Jesus Christ, these are killing me. Ah! And then they had them redesigned. So it's just one of those things where he had to be in their shoes, I guess.
Well, I always heard a story. Jerry Jarrett told him about it. Whether he did anything then, I don't know. But, yeah, when he's that'd be a good way to get a ring change. Put the guy in charge of the company in the ring, have him take a few bumps to let him know what his talent is having to put up with. And yeah, and not only does that help the talent, it makes for better matches because you get better work out of the guys, and they're not getting killed. And especially see Vince Senior used to use a lot of older talent. They couldn't take those bumps. That actually break their bones. He would use in talents over 50, a lot of them, because they had been with him for years and they were his friends. So he would use them, but they didn't take any bumps, so the ring wasn't an issue then. So
we sure
is that cleared up now?
I think we've been very thorough on that.
Okay,
indeed.
Okay.
We're gonna move on. Graham says, do you have any stories on Henry O. Godwin, aka Mark Canterbury? He was a big guy saddled with a pretty crappy gimmick. I mean, he wasn't everybody at that time in the mid-90s, but maybe doesn't get his props as a solid worker and promo as well. What say you?
Well, I didn't get to know him a lot. He was in the faction. If I'd have been aligning myself with factions of the Shawn Michaels faction or the Undertaker faction, he was in the Undertaker faction. And that faction was called what? What was it called?
The BSKs.
And what's that mean?
I think it was Bone Street Crew. I think that stood for, with K for crew.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Bone Street Crew. I don't know where that came from. But he was in there, and, you know, I don't think they wanted me and Bradshaw around them too much. So we didn't align ourselves with either group. Not that either group wanted us, but, and I didn't really get to know him. I know that he's from somewhere, I think in West Virginia. Am I correct there?
Good question. Carry on.
So I don't know. And I don't know where he started. I know very little about him, except that he was always a good guy. Henry was, he was the first Godwin, right?
Yeah. And then he was joined by Phineas. And then very briefly, they were joined by Hillbilly Jim. And then they were joined by Dirty White Boy for about a week as Uncle Cletus.
Yeah, I think Dirty White Boy came in when I think Vince had like an epiphany, and he wanted to bring in a lot of gimmicks in. So he brought Dirty White Boy in, and he brought
Gracie Smothers.
Yeah, I think he brought him in and a few more.
The goon.
Brought the goon in. And none of those guys worked out. None of them worked out because you may have, if you'd have staggered their entrance a little bit, but you can't bring in a bunch of guys at one time and they're all gimmicks. You gotta have a placement. And because if you got too many people you're trying to get over at the same time, and what happens is none of them got over. So, but yeah, the Henry Godwin was actually a pretty good gimmick, I thought. And it would have worked if they'd have had time to get it over. Big guy and good guy to be around. So I liked him.
Okay, with just because I've decided to go on this, right, so the new generation era, so from 93, 94, 95, 96, around that era, and you were there for 95 and 96, what were the worst characters, what were the worst gimmicks at the time? Because I've got a list of them here. I mean, Henry Godwin, maybe not, that was a bit outdated, I guess, but, you know, we had the goon, we had, who did we say?
The goon was a bad gimmick.
Yep, Isaac Yankem.
Read them off to me, I can't remember them.
Isaac Yankem. The Sultan.
Oh, horrible. That was a horrible. It was worse than horrible. What's a level less than horrible? Pathetic. It was actually pathetic. And I felt sorry for Glenn trying to do it. I really did. Because there was nothing to that. I mean, there was no really any kind of a line between a dentist, what would happen in a dentist office and in the ring.
Do you think that it's one of those things that Vince McMahon just has a toothache one day and just hates his dentist and makes a character? It could be like that linear.
I think they all sat around a table one day smoking dope or drinking rum or whatever, getting drunk, and coming up with the stupidest or the most stupid ideas that I think a creative team can come up with. None of them draw a dime. Isaac Yankem. I didn't mind the name that much, but that's where it ended. It was terrible. What was another one?
The Sultan, your best friend Rikishi, was a mute Sultan from Samoa.
I never got it. I never understood it. Nobody else did either.
Duke the Dumpster Drozy.
Horrible.
He was doing that before the WWF, I think.
And it was still horrible. If he thought of it or whoever thought about it should be relieved of their position and docked 3 months of future earnings.
Do you know, there's a joke about, I don't know if it was a joke or if it was a genuine bet. Apparently, Duke the Dumpster Drozy, he had another name on the indies. And someone bet somebody, Vince or whoever, that they couldn't take somebody who was number 500 on the PWI 500 list of like the year 93 or 92 or something and make a star out of them. And apparently that's where they got Duke the Dumpster Drozy. He was number 500 of 500 on some list of PWI.
I've never heard that story before.
There you go. Well, someone write in and tell me if that's like an apocryphal tale.
Okay, I've never heard the story. And that sounds very unlike Vince.
Yeah.
That Vince could take the guy on the 500 list and make him something. He'd have made him something better than that, surely. You know, with all the things I've heard about Vince being a super mind, and his claim to fame is he invented Undertaker. But it's not so much that he invented Undertaker. You can mark that down to Mark taking the gimmick and making it work. They told him what they wanted, and I never asked him or anything, but how it came about, because Mark is, I don't think he's told anybody who was his advice guy. Has he?
He may have done, but he may have done on one of the Stone Cold podcasts of the video. I'm going to give you a fact. You'll like this that I read recently. Is that the Undertaker name had to be bought from Puerto Rico because there was a tag team in 1990 in IWA, the other one, Carlos's, or maybe it was even an indie, but I think it might have been WWC called The Undertakers. And they spent, Vince McMahon paid like $3,000 for the rights to the name The Undertaker.
For a team in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, from a team in Puerto Rico, yeah.
You know, I got to call bullshit on that. I'm going to have to throw the flag if I had one. I throw the flag on that one. I never heard that before in my life either. Where do you get these little tidbits of wisdom?
It's all up there. No, actually, I read that quite recently. I thought that'd be interesting. I'm going to give you some more of the worst characters ever. Flash Funk, that was Too Cold Scorpio. He gave him some sort of like dancing pimp thing.
Well, that I think they could have done something with that because the Flash Funk is just a name and the dance is just a presentation. But I think Too Cold Scorpio was a better worker. He may have made that been able to be passable, but never like a big money draw.
Clarence Mason, the little lawyer guy. He was a real lawyer, apparently.
That's bullshit, too.
A real lawyer practicing in Florida, I think.
No. Well, wait a minute. It don't even make sense. Why would a real lawyer leave a real job to go prance around? Wouldn't that have hurt his practice wherever it was in Florida?
Probably.
Well, I remember I rode with him one night with Bradshaw. Oh, my God. Bradshaw was on that guy, ribbing him and playing with him. I think the guy almost started crying. He wanted to get out, but it was dark and it was 1 o'clock in the morning. We didn't know where we were. He didn't either. So, but he didn't ride with us much after that. So I don't believe he was a lawyer. I'd never heard that before in my life. You think you would hear if he was a real lawyer, you would think that you would have heard that, don't you think?
I can't remember. I think he's like Herman something Jr. or something is his real name. I can't remember his real name, but I actually looked him up and Googled it, and he does have a practice in Florida. Wait,
that's two flags that I've thrown in the last two questions. Okay, we'll check that out. If anybody has any feelings on that or information, let us know.
Okay, I'm
because this is a very educational experience for all of us, even me. So
I'm gonna skip the next one. I'm not even gonna tell you the names because I'll make that a future question because that's got its own idea. That one was in 97, so that was after you left. Barry Windham as the Stalker, where he'd paint his face up. Basically like a Rambo character with PTSD in the woods, and he threatened to disembowel people, basically. And then he debuted as a babyface.
Boy, I tell you, you can't get very more touching to people's hearts than threatening to disembowel them. Mm. I mean, that kind of puts you on a individual basis with the guy. And I kind of remember that, but, you know, it's like, you know, after a while, you don't got to be in a business a long time. Just look at something and say, that ain't going to go. That ain't going to go. The fans look at it first, and if they reject it, that's done. You might as well get rid of it right that second. Dump it.
Well, speaking of rejecting immediately, number two on this list is the New Rockers. Marty Jannetty and Al Snow, who was going under the name Leaf Cassidy.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, Leaf Cassidy? And it don't even make sense. What's he, Norwegian now? Or all of a sudden? What the hell is he?
The name was taken from two different heartthrobs. I don't know what and the Leaf they were, is, but David Cassidy was one.
And, of course, everybody knew they were trying to replace Shawn Michaels. And it just didn't work. I mean, if they'd have probably seen that team first, they may have gotten over. But they saw Shawn and Marty together, that they were great together. I didn't like the way they kind of split him up when, you know, Sean put him through that glass on that barbershop deal or whatever segment they had. That wasn't a bad little segment on its own, the barbershop. Because everybody knows you go in the barbershop, talk about everything, this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't a bad name for a little talking segment because they let you in on all the dirt and all this. But when he put Marty Jannetty through that broken glass, they showed the kids in the crowd, the little kids, they're going, oh, my God. See, that's why I always say never do any angle that a 10-year-old kid wouldn't understand. And they understood that. And that set Shawn Michaels on his path, single path to stardom. And we saw what he did with that. And he did a great job.
And number one, we're not going to go in on this because we've already talked about it. I'm just going to go straight to the next question. But number one on this, how could it be anyone else but our friend Shane Douglas as Dean Douglas? We're going to leave it there because we have talked about it recently. So we're going to go straight to the next question. Drew.
Yeah, but okay, wait just a second. Dean Douglas, they didn't give him even a chance, really. I mean, that was reversed from the beginning. I mean, they could have done a lot better with that. I think it wouldn't ever got over big time, but they didn't give him a proper introduction. He was just the dean of some unknown college or university or whatever he was. And you never really saw him. I never saw him on a college campus. Did you?
No,
I never saw him pulling up and all the kids are there and, you know, the big, you know, tower that a lot of universities have or something that's synonymous with a certain college. I never saw that or never saw him in class, never saw any of that stuff. But because they never did it. So that's why I'm saying they never give him a chance.
They did vignettes with him in front of a blackboard, and that was pretty much it. And they gave him the worst dialogue to recite, and they said, "Don't do it like the franchise. Do it like a boring teacher." And it's like, well,
that's horrible.
Yeah, that's going to really shift some tickets. Is a well done, right? Right.
That's a sellout as soon as you do it.
Right, moving on. Drew Wilson, really big fan of the podcast and all your other stuff, but my stepfather was from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And he always told a story about how a fan entered the ring while there was a match between you and Randy Savage, and either you or Savage beat the crap out of that guy. Do you have any recollection of that incident in Murfreesboro, Tennessee? Thanks in advance, and again, huge fan.
Oh, I remember that night. Yeah, the guy was a member of the Hells Angels. And he came in and he punched Savage and knocked Savage down. And then he looked at me and he said, "Hey, we'll get him." I said, "Yeah, we'll get him." And I hit him. Oh, my. And I stomped the. You believe in it so far?
Carry on.
No, I made that up.
Thank God. Did you and Booker T and CM Punk have a fight in NXT last week?
Yeah, we did. We did, but don't. Don't say nothing about it because I don't want to get the internet stirred up. No, I don't remember anybody coming into the ring. Not then with Savage. And if anybody got him, it would be Savage. It wouldn't have been me because I'm a big chicken shit. I don't like I don't like people being mad at something else and me trying to straighten it out. No, I'm just I do not remember that. I lived in Murfreesboro a long time. I liked that town. And I left there about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and came to Florida where it's warm. And now this past month, it's been colder than hell. And I tell my daughter, she used to say, "Come to Florida. It'll be fine. It'll be warm. I like to froze my ass off down here." I said, "Damn." But if anybody beat him up, it would have been Savage. It wouldn't have been me. So, and I don't know what story he's telling, but. But who told him that story? His grandfather?
Yes.
It's 100% true. His grandfather told him, it's 100% true.
We'll move on then. Tamara says, hi, Dutch, love the show. I have a question about bookers in WCW during your run there. What did you think of Magnum TA as a booker? I think he was co-booker at the time. And did you ever have any run-ins with George Scott? Thank you.
I never had any run-ins with George Scott. Really never worked for him, really. I was scheduled to go into North Carolina, and I forgot what happened. Something happened, and I was booked there, and I just never went for some reason. That's very unlike me, but I just turned and went back home. I was living in Murfreesboro, what we're talking about now. I just went back home. As far as Magnum TA as a booker, I don't think he was the booker. I think when he came back from that horrific accident that he was in, I think Dusty put him in a spot.
He was like assistant booker, wasn't he, or something?
Assistant booker, which is, he just, I don't know how many ideas he came up with. He may have come up with several, I don't know. But I think he was just there kind of helping out and like backing up Dusty on what he thought about certain things. And as any individual contributions, I don't know what he made because I wasn't in there. But he had been around the business enough, I think, by that time, even though he was still green. And for him to even get a booker's job at that age was kind of unheard of. Because usually bookers were like in their late 40s, maybe in 50s, because they had seen a lot, done a lot, and dealt with a lot of the very same wrestlers they were booking at that time. So bookers usually got the job after they were through working or close to getting through working, except for Dusty. Dusty, he booked a lot of the Mid-Atlantic, the Carolina territories. And from what I hear, this is what I've heard, Dusty, he just booked the main events. You know, he just decided what he wanted to do with the main events. And that's why Dusty, if the Rock and Roll was on top and they were hot as fire, Ricky Morton told me this, well, Dusty would book himself in a six-man. So now Dusty is the main event in a six-man. And if Nikita Koloff, that was his guy, if him and Magnum TA are hot, well, all of a sudden, Dusty was in a tag team with them. So on these big shows like Greensboro and Atlanta, you know, Dusty was always, well, he was going to be close to the top anyway, but Dusty made sure that he was in that main event because they was paying him big money, and Dusty was a draw. He was exciting. So, but I've met a few of them that says that, especially Ricky, I asked him one time, what was he making? And I had in my head what I thought he should be making. And yeah, he was making good money, very good money, but not what I thought he should have been making. I mean, I kept my mouth shut. I didn't say nothing to him, but what I did ask him, I said, how much, and I knew how much money he had turned over. And I think we talked about this on the regular show last Friday. We talked about gimmicks, you know, in Memphis, you could have your gimmick money, but in Charlotte, I guess you couldn't. But I guess they were killing it on Rock and Roll gimmicks, on the T-shirts and all, and the pictures. And I asked him how much he got of that. He said, nothing. I said, you had to get something. He said, well, now I don't know if he was bullcrapping me or whatever, but he said they didn't get, or if what they got wasn't anywhere close to what they, even a percentage they would have come up with. So that's one way they can actually pay your salary and actually come out ahead by paying you. Probably the gimmicks were paying Robert and Ricky's salary. So it's hard to believe, but yeah, it can happen. It really can.
Next question. Bill Wade, Chattanooga. Hi, Dutch. Great podcast. I listen every week when I can. I watched you in Chattanooga in the mid-70s. The Bounty Hunters were also there at that time. Why were they never pushed to the big time? They had a great gimmick and were good wrestlers. Thanks.
Well, they had a good gimmick. They were like Hell's Angels type guys, but I don't think the motorcycles were ever brought into anything. They were just rough looking guys, and their style fit Tennessee style. Tennessee's never been a technical wrestling territory. It's not like you see in AEW. You never saw two guys get in the ring and wrestle, and you saw two guys get in the ring and start brawling and then brawl out of the ring and brawl up into the stands. And then the ring was just there for appearances. They damn sure didn't get in there except for the introduction and maybe the finish. Mm-hmm. That's when it's like all of a sudden they looked around the ring. Wait a minute. Who put a ring in here? What a place to end the match. And then they throw it in there and do the finish. I mean, the ring was like, it was just there. Like Abdullah, his whole match was on the floor. Brody, his whole match was on the floor. These aren't Chattanooga guys, but I'm saying Stan Hansen. They spent very little time in the ring. But in Tennessee, yeah, that's where a lot of people had their matches, were outside the ring. And I don't know why they didn't really make another big name for themselves. I think Tennessee was the only place they ever went. And I don't think they were good salesmen or they didn't have anybody pitching for them. They just never made it anywhere else.
Next question is from Chris Bedard, if I pronounced your name correctly, Knoxville, Tennessee. My question is, did you ever think that you knew Smoky Mountain Wrestling was a doomed project from the start? And if so, did you try and warn Jim Cornette?
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was a doomed project from the start. I thought it was odd that they picked Knoxville as their big town. I mean, Knoxville wouldn't. It's not a. Most of the companies that were like offices back in the day, they were in a big town, a big metropolitan town like Dallas, like Atlanta, like Tampa, or like Nashville or Memphis, Charlotte, big town. But Knoxville was like, he only had like a 160,000 population. And that's just not, I mean, that's just in the town. It was probably had close to 500,000 in the metro area, but still, I thought that their main TV was in a town the size of Knoxville, which was for other territories, it would be just like a satellite house show or satellite TV. I mean, it would be stuck out there in the woods somewhere. And they drew pretty well in Knoxville, but not to the point that it could support the whole territory. It's like, say, Atlanta back in the day. They could run Atlanta and probably make enough on Atlanta to pay their bills for the week and to pay their talent. Or like Florida could run Tampa or Miami and have enough and draw enough there to pay their whole week for all over the state. But Knoxville, it couldn't do it. And they ran towns that were, I don't know, they'd run towns you never heard of. Now, sometimes they do very well, but the ticket prices were cheap, had to be. But, and I didn't see that it was doomed until Cornette, and I don't know if he ever stopped going up to WWF, but I think he started working back with them while Smoky Mountain was going on.
Yeah, 93 he started going up, so about like the middle of 93, maybe August, September, so halfway in Smoky Mountain's life cycle is when Cornette started doing WWF stuff at the same time.
Because I was in Smoky Mountain in 93, but I was only doing the announcing. But I couldn't make enough just on one announcing gig or two. He paid me for two. I do two shows, but I wasn't making enough money for me to hold those dates, because it was on a Monday. Usually that's when he would do the, I think sometimes he'd do a Saturday night. I don't know. I don't remember. But anyway, I went to Puerto Rico and I heard right from then that Cornette started going back into the, then I went to WWF after 93. I went to 94.
95.
I was in Puerto Rico in 94. I went to 95, 96, and Cornette was there. Mm-hmm. So it didn't surprise me.
Where would you have headquartered it then? So not Knoxville, because didn't USWA run Knoxville at this time as well?
No.
They didn't run Knoxville this time.
No, that was a Memphis town. Okay. And I hated that name anyway, USWA. What the hell?
It was a mouthful.
It sounded like a damn, some kind of damn dragster strip. USWA drag. I don't know. I didn't quite get it. Memphis was based, USWA was based in Memphis. I never got why they changed it from the CWA, but I think that had something to do. You know a movie I saw?
Go on.
I'm bringing it up right now. The Iron Claw.
So you've seen it finally, have you?
Yes, I have. And you've seen it.
I've seen it.
What do you think? I got confused by it. I knew the story.
Well, I thought I knew the story as well. I thought it was good and it wasn't great. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? Oh, no, I just told you what I thought. But there were... there were things that were left out that shouldn't have been left out. And I'm not even talking about like Chris Von Erich and stuff like that. I just think they should have focused as much on the downfall of the business and why the downfall happened, because that's half the story. And that's a human interest story, not a wrestling story, even though it's based in wrestling. And I thought that should have really been focused on a lot more. And I said this before.
Why do you think the downfall was? What was it?
Well, people kept dying and then they kept doing really...
That's a bad thing. If you push in this talent, this character or whatever, and they keep dying. Hmm. Stop it, guys, please.
And then Fritz did that fake cousin, and then he did the fake heart attack, and then, you know, the real deaths, and it just wasn't... I'm not sure it could have been salvaged with the WWF, because nothing survived the WWF, but I don't know.
Okay, this is one part of it that confused me.
Okay.
When Kerry, he was in that motorcycle accident, did it take his whole foot off or just part of his foot off?
Neither. So he injured his foot in a motorcycle accident. Although the only person who's ever said different was Shane Douglas, and he said it was a quad bike accident, and he tipped over and the peg, and you know the foot peg landed and crushed his foot. But most other people say it was a motorcycle accident. But he didn't lose the foot because of that. He tried to get back on his feet too early, and that's what ended up causing the foot to have to be amputated. But in the film, he's lost half his leg. Which also wasn't right.
Yeah, I heard that he had lost half a foot, because I do remember he used to come to the matches fully dressed to wrestle. He'd already have his boots on and everything. And he would never get undressed at the building, ever. And he would leave and never take his boots off. I do know, I remember that. So, but that confused me. I never knew the true story on that.
What else about the film? The good and the bad. What did you think?
Actually, I liked Kevin's wife. I liked her. They're still married, right?
Kevin, yeah.
And I think the boys, they painted them out as a really loving family, except for Fritz. He was he'd bring a crackhead down. But
he was a good actor, that guy, as well. I thought the Fritz actor was the best.
Well, yeah, he was pretty good. The okay, who was the worst?
Oh, the Ric Flair one. Jeez, God, where did they he was drag horrible. Him up from whatever panto?
But let me tell you who I think, and you only saw him maybe 30 seconds of the whole film. It was the guy who played Jerry Jarrett.
Yeah.
He actually sounded like him, looked like him, because they didn't do close-ups. You saw it from a distance. And, you know, I was in Memphis when all this was going on. I mean, Jerry Jarrett would, he would put us on a bus on a Thursday night, and we would drive all the way down to Dallas from Memphis on a bus. We'd probably run some show over there close to Memphis or whatever. And then either the bus would be there or we'd meet it back somewhere in Memphis and then we'd go. I think I made it two or three times and I says, screw this, I'm not doing it. And I left. We weren't knocking it dead at the bank. Now, I know Dallas wasn't drawing, but you got to make it worth my time, too. And I just, instead of saying I need more money and going through all that, I just left.
Did Kevin and Kerry own USWA at that time, or Dallas at that time? Was it still Fritz when you were involved?
I never knew who was there. The whole thing was never explained to me, and I was talking to Jerry Jarrett 3, 4, 5 times a week. And he said he had bought in or something like that, but he never gave details of it. But I do know of going down there and being on the TV, and Jerry was booking it. And I don't know how long that lasted. I don't think it lasted that long. Maybe a year, maybe. I don't know, because, you know, when I'm through with the territory, I'm just through it. I don't care what they do. If I'm not there involved in it, I don't care. So I don't know what happened to it or what made it all fall through. I have no idea. I told you about the time that I think it was Kerry was the second one.
Kevin was the oldest.
Oh, it was.
It was Kerry. Sorry, it was Kevin, then David, then Kerry, I think.
Who's the one living now?
Kevin.
Well, it was him. Did I tell you the story about in Jonesboro, Arkansas?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, just turned up halfway through the match. Yeah.
Man. Yeah. Well, no, he showed up right before the match. Yeah. Because we had written him out, and I'm glad we written him, because he was messed up. He was drunk as Cooter Brown. And he showed up, and it would have been okay to go ahead and do the match without him, because nobody had seen him all night. Because he came to the show and then left, and then he walked back through the crowd. So now, the crowd, they all know he's there. So we can't go out there and say, well, you know, we got a replacement here for Kerry Von Erich, because they'd already seen him. And that's when he put that claw on me. Oh, he almost knocked my ass out. Bam. So anyway.
Would how many stars out of 5 then, the Meltzer star system for the film?
Well, if it had been in Japan, it'd been 6. Right. If it had been in Japan. But since it was in Jonesboro, it was about a 2. It was kind of a... Because Kevin didn't know where he was supposed to be, when he was supposed to be.
No, I don't mean the match. I mean the film itself. Oh. How many stars?
Oh, the film. Oh, I'll give it a... I won't give it... I was reading about it. It said, it's Academy Award winning. Bullshit. I don't think it was that damn good. It was well produced, I will say that. And I'll give it about a... I'll go a 2 or 3. I'll give it a 3 out of 5. Is like in the middle.
Right. Very quickly, just because we got off the topic of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, if you weren't going to headquarter it in Knoxville, where would you have headquartered it at that time that would have made sense?
That was the biggest town. You got it. And he wasn't really headquartered in Knoxville. It was like 30 miles outside of Knoxville. He was like in a suburb of Well, it's not even a suburb of Knoxville. It's Morristown.
Yeah, Morristown, yeah.
Yeah, a small town. And Jimmy had a lot to worry about in those days. Who was the owner of that? Who was the guy?
Oh, Rick Rubin. Yeah, he was the money man, at least. Rick
yeah. Rubin. I didn't know that he even had anything to do with it after it was over. Because they kept it quiet and they didn't tell me nothing. I didn't know who Rick Rubin was.
Not a big Beastie Boys fan then?
No, I'm not.
No, fair enough. Right.
Would I have known who he was if I was a Beastie Boy fan?
Probably not. I mean, unless you were really into the lore of them. I mean, he was just the producer. Right, we're going to move on. Scott says, hey guys, watch every episode and love them so much. Can you tell me if you wrestled or met with Tim Horner? He lives in my hometown. Great guy, quiet and unassuming. Always helps in any charity in town. I know that he and Cornette dislike each other very much. Maybe they were in business here in Morristown, Tennessee for a short time. Very short time. So Morristown, Tennessee, straight away. So Tim Horner stories.
Oh, they hated each other. Cornette and Horner. I mean, you couldn't even put them in the same room. I forgot what happened to cause the initial fallout. But I think Tim had done something. Because, you know, Cornette has a really quick temper. You know, it was like a matchstick temper. Boom, he can go off. But they didn't like each other. And I think they did have something to do. And Tim lives in Morristown too, I think. So they may have done a deal over that. And I think another thing, Cornette was running around trying to get the TV together. And Horner was telling them one thing. And then Cornette was telling them another. So that was a bone of contention between them. And I remember he stood up one day and just cussed him out in front of everybody. And Tim just said, okay, and went and I think he had like a notebook or something. He just closed it up and walked out the door and didn't see him again the rest of the night. I didn't see him again for like a month. Because I didn't do their house shows. I just did the TV like, I think once a month or once every 2 weeks or whatever they did. So I wasn't over there that much. Yeah, they didn't like each other at all.
What do you think of Tim? I've heard a couple of people say Tim Horner was fantastic, technical wrestler, or really, really easy to work with. Did you actually wrestle him?
Yeah, I did. He was good. Not as good as me, of course.
Of course.
I mean, that goes without saying. No, he was good. He was good in the ring. And he wouldn't hurt you, and he'd knock the crap out of you. And he understood what a match should be. And you could have great matches with him. See, Tim's big drawback, he couldn't talk. You know, he would, when he went to other places, he had the accent of East Tennessee. And it was easy to tell that he didn't, it's not even a Southern accent. It's a different accent. And he wasn't a good talker anyway. So, and that held him back. And, but even him having the accent in Eastern Tennessee, which everybody has more or less, he still couldn't talk. So you've heard of Ron Wright, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Ron Wright, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was the big star of Smoky Mountain, Tennessee, because he'd been around there for years and years and years. And while he was able to get over so well is he never went on the road in another territory. He was just always around Knoxville. And the way that a lot of the outside promoters did when Nashville had its main office was this guy named John Kazanis. He owned the Knoxville area. He was like the promoter there, and he would use Nashville talent, and he had his own TV. So, and Ron Wright would work for Kazanis, and Kazanis used him well because he's a local guy. I mean, he didn't have to chase him down, and he had no, he knew when he booked him in something, he'd be there. See, if you were using the talent out of Tennessee and out of Nashville, and it's about 300 miles away, well, a talent in Tennessee got pissed off at something and leave. Well, if you just, if the promoter in Knoxville had just used him there, well, he's just gone. But he would keep his local talent around, so he had something to fall back on. But that Ron Wright was over, and he had a twin brother named Don. It was Ron and Don Wright. And but his big claim to fame, he had some brass knuckles. And what he would do right in the middle of it, he would carve like a little blade, and it would come up. So he could take it like this, pull the guy's hair back, and tap him with it. Blood all over the place. So he gave it to me one night. I knew nothing about the little raised area, like little sharp area in the middle. And I hit my hand, and I still got a scar. I don't know if you can see it, but it's still. See that scar? Can you see it? Or any?
Maybe.
Anyway, but that's what I did. And I'm walking around bleeding from my hand. People say, what happened? What happened? How'd you do that? It's bleeding like a son of a gun. You know, to get your hand to bleed is kind of a bad cut. So, but I didn't tell anybody that I took Ron Wright's gimmick knucks and hit myself and like bladed myself. So I think they would think, well, what an idiot. He didn't know. But I didn't. But anyway, Ron Wright and Cornette inherited him, and they did a lot of stuff, good stuff with Ron.
We'll ask you the two or three more questions, and we'll wrap it up depending on how quick the answers are. Ben says, hi, Dutch. As a kid, the great Kabuki and Kendo Nagasaki scared me. Do you have any stories about either of them? Thank you.
It scared me too.
Why?
No, they didn't scare me. But I could see how he could scare little kids because they were different. They looked rough. They looked, I mean, sometimes a little kid, you'll get a feeling from a little kid that you might not get yourself. So the little kids are afraid of them because they're putting off something, not words. It's mostly visual and just a feeling. So if a little kid does that, you're probably thinking, well, regular people do too. So, and this was like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, maybe 30 anyway. So, but when they came onto the floor, that's what those foreign heels did. When they walked on the floor, you knew you weren't going to like them. It's like the Nazis walking onto the floor. We had a war against them. We had a war against the Japanese. So when they walked out there, they were trouble. So you didn't like them. So you can't even do that today. Say, because if you do it, you're like racist, or you're like, what's it called? If you don't like people from the other country, what's that called?
Xenophobic.
Xenophobic. Yeah, that's right. Right. But, and you don't want to be called any of those names. So you just sit there and say, oh, I don't know. Unless the guy comes out and he speaks English and he's from the South. He's automatically a no good son of a gun. So you can, he attacks the fans. So, but that's what he felt with the kids, and they were a good team.
Did you wrestle either of them? Because I've heard more about Great Kabuki. There's a Kendo Nagasaki, an English version, but
yes,
I don't know very much
him.
About the Japanese version.
He wasn't even Japanese, was he?
No, he's English.
What the hell? What were y'all trying to do over there?
I know.
Did
you ever wrestle?
No, I never
wrestled.
No, I did not.
No. Where was his biggest stardom in the States?
Well, I think probably.
Was he in Dallas? I think he might have been in Dallas at one point.
He was over there, and he was over in Atlanta, right? Or no?
Could well be.
I don't know. I really don't know. Can't figure it out. Look it up. Go to Google.
I'm Googling it. I'm going to pause. Right, okay, I've got to 1978. He was in Florida. Where else? God, he was in Florida for a long time. Where else was he in? Well, this is, I'm sure this is scintillating podcasting here, me just like scrolling through.
Wait a minute.
At St. Louis, he was in Big Time Wrestling. Texas, who was Big Time Wrestling? That was Fritz, wasn't it?
Big Time? No, that was Championship Wrestling for Texas, I think.
No sports.
Big Time, I think, was Kansas City.
No, there was loads of Big Time. Like Detroit was Big Time. San Francisco, I think, was Big Time. Everything was Big Time. Yeah, no, he was in Dallas. He was in Georgia. Yeah, okay, he did the rounds. All right, I'll ask this one. Spencer Yates says, "Hello, Dutch and James. Bad news, Alan is one of the wrestlers who was universally respected among other wrestlers. I was wondering if you were ever around Bad News, Alan." No, I think we already discussed this. You weren't, were you? But there's a follow-up question. No, so there's a follow-up question. "I always found it funny that he had a feud in WWE against Ken Patera. They billed Allen as a street thug, but in reality, Allen had won a bronze medal in judo in the 1976 Olympics, and they billed Ken Patera as an Olympic hero, even though he was too hungover to do anything at the 1972 Olympics, and had just done 2 years in the clink before this feud." Any thoughts of Ken?
What do you say about Ken? Ken was what?
He was too hungover to achieve anything. Yeah,
I got that. And I never heard that story. What was the right before then? Right before Ken Patera? What's this?
Oh, they billed Allen, Bad News Allen, as a street thug, but Bad News Allen was an Olympian in judo.
Yeah, and they billed what? Ken Patera as what?
As an Olympic hero, and he didn't medal at all, and he was too hungover to place. Well,
oh, okay.
How many times have you met Ken over the years?
Couple of times. Where not else? Much. Not much. He was quiet. Quiet guy. I met him in, I think, they used him in Memphis a couple of times when Memphis was trying to do the Minneapolis thing. But they tried to join forces against the WWE.
Pro Wrestling USA. Yeah.
Oh, and that didn't work at all. But even though I'm thinking, how would this work? I think, you know, it didn't make sense to me because the territories were really so different, even in presentation, because Minneapolis did a lot of wrestling. That was the farthest thing on Memphis's mind. It was, let's do something, let's start a big brawl and just, you know, let's bring in some baseball bats and a car and let's set somebody on fire or drop them out of the ceiling. Anything that you could keep them watching that TV. Minneapolis, they like to do like controlled announcing. Yeah, this is Ken so-and-so from Minneapolis. But it wasn't like, yo, it wasn't like Lance Russell. It was just different. So that didn't work out. So, and I'm glad because I didn't want to be making it. I didn't like anything up north that had a ring to it of being cold. I hate being in cold weather.
Do you know, because that's a good point you bring up. I know you don't like Pro Wrestling USA because for some reason they just jobbed you out to Harley Race in 2 minutes. We saw that a few weeks ago. We did the watch along.
You just had to show it, didn't you?
You insisted. No, you didn't insist. I insisted. But it was fun to watch. But is that one of the reasons you think that, among many, that Pro Wrestling USA just didn't work whatsoever? It was not only just too many, was it cooks in the kitchen kind of thing with their own opinions, but there are just too many disparate styles of what wrestling should be in the minds of the head collaborators.
Yeah.
So how would that work on a national basis? So you've got Memphis one, Memphis guy versus Ken Patera the next. How would that even work across the board?
I don't know. Apparently it didn't even work in the creative rooms. You know, Jerry Jarrett was pretty creative. You know, Nick Bockwinkle, to me, I don't think in the long run in Memphis, I thought he would have died in Memphis. Unless he'd have had to do some go in there and do some of that crazy stuff. And I don't think Nick was crazy about that style. He wanted to wrestle. And of course, up there, he could wrestle. But down in Memphis, if he wanted to draw any money, he'd have to open it up. I mean, now they tried to hold the earlier matches down in Memphis because that was all the later matches were. It was just a wild, out of control fight. But it worked in Memphis. I don't think it would work in Minneapolis. They would have to be brought into it a little more gradually.
Would the opposite work in AWA? Did you ever hear of any Memphis guys or anything like that go up there, do their thing? Everyone loved it, or did they just hate it because they expected Nick?
Lawler went up there, and he did his Lawler stuff. I guess they liked it, okay. But I didn't hear him drawing any sellouts up there or anything. But wrestling has a certain style in every place you go, and you got to assist. And when you go in there, you got to work the style of the territory for a while anyway. See, that's why you didn't get guys like, say, Abdullah in Minneapolis. Because he has that wide-open style. I don't think Brody, he may have been in there. He wasn't there long. Or Hanson.
He was a former AWA champion briefly.
But long time ago. That was like 10 or 15 years before they tried to join up in Memphis, I think.
I've got a fun fact for you, and we're going to leave it on this. I can only find
will
two.
Will I throw the flag on this one?
No, this is a quiz question for you. So, okay. Pro Wrestling USA taping that you lost to Harley Race in.
Yes.
You wrestled twice that night. Do you remember the other person you wrestled and lost to?
I lost twice in one night?
Oh, God, yeah.
In Memphis, the main town.
Mid-South Coliseum, you lost
no
again.
No shit. And I'm saying, guys, wait a minute. I know what you're trying to do. And I kept bringing this up. Why are you beating me? Not one time was enough. Oh, well, that's the world champion. I said, I don't give a shit. He's not known here as the world champion. We don't have a world champion except for Lawler. And, you know, he had everything. Who was the other one I lost to?
He wasn't a Memphis regular either.
Who was he?
Former NWA champion.
Funk? Dory?
Dory Funk Jr.
Oh, well, I lost. Oh. Well, no wonder. I lost. Here's a great, great, if we hadn't already exposed it, that's a great, great trivia question. Who lost two falls in the same night to two former world champions in his own territory?
Don't write in, everybody. You probably know the answer after that.
Yes.
But there you go. There's a nice little trivia fact.
Wait a minute. How long did me and Dory go?
Doesn't say. It just says that you were defeated. But it says Harley Race was 2 minutes and 6 seconds. So we don't know. We just know if you're going to lose to two people, though, you know, unless it's, you know, in Memphis.
I still remember Jerry, and I love Jerry. And I remember what he was trying to do. So I went along with it. You know, I kind of made it a joke and went on. I went, damn, one time's not enough for you. I got to do it again. I said, why did you needed to take bets on this, Jerry? If I'd lost, already lost to Harley, what if you said, I bet Dutch gets beat again? Oh, I'll bet not. Nah, they won't beat him twice in one night. They're not that stupid. I said, hell, you could have made some money tonight. But this time, what did I lose to Harley Race on the first one? What did he do?
I don't know. Did he suplex you? It's probably just a suplex and a pin.
I think he just suplexed me, a little one.
A suplex, maybe.
Oh, yeah. And I think Dory probably put spinning a forward leg lock on me. Or
the leg hump.
Bigger force.
I still think that's the worst yeah, finisher yeah, of all time.
The leg hole. Yeah. That's a good one. Well, folks, I've done it all. So
there you go. You've had your leg humped many times.
I've I played the game and I've lost the game. So, but that's what they do sometimes.
There you go. On that note, we're going to close down this podcast. Thank you, everybody, for watching. Questions for Dutch at gmail.com. If you intend to write in a question for this, not this one, this one's over, but future episodes of Ask Dutch Anything, and as I say a lot, so many people do. There's like, we're not getting to a tenth of the questions. We really aren't. We get so many in, but please keep writing them in. And, you know, if we don't get to it, eventually write in again at some point, and hopefully it'll get picked that time. But for now, thank you very much for watching. We'll be back again with story time with Dutch Mantel on Friday. And Dutch, we the people.
We the people.